From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Just 1 week left now to the big deadline to sign up for coverage under the Affordable Care Act. March 31st, a week from today, doors close for the year. Millions have signed up, but millions more are still uninsured, many uncertain. The White House has pushed hard to get young Americans into the mix. Critics still hope it will fail or be repealed. Meanwhile, Obamacare is rolling ahead. How's it doing? Will it all work? This hour, On Point, we're checking in on Obamacare 1 week before the big sign-up deadline. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you signed up? Are you holding out? For what? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The White House pulling out all the stops to get people signed up, young people in particular. Last week, the White House released an ad featuring NBA star LeBron James, urging people to sign up before a week from today.
Hi, I'm LeBron James. I know how important it is to take care of yourself, your friends, and your family. That's why I want to tell you about the health insurance marketplace at healthcare.gov. You can go there to find an affordable health plan as part of the healthcare law. The deadline to enroll is March 31st, so sign up now. You never know when you might take a hit.
LeBron says sign up. A lot of critics are saying, don't go there. We don't want this. A week ago, RNC Republican National Committee Chairman Reince Priebus appeared on CNN's State of the Union with Candy Crowley talking about Republican Congressman David Jolly's victory in a special election in Florida. Priebus gave a big part of the credit for that win to public resistance, he said, to the Affordable Care Act.
Obamacare is complete poison out there in the field. And so the lesson is going to be, number one, you have to hit your main target, which is Obamacare.
And here comes the deadline. Joining me now from Washington is Noam Levy, national healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Noam, thank you very much for being with us. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Also with us from Berkeley, California, is Jenny Gold, healthcare reporter for Kaiser Health News. It's an editorially independent news service, a program of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Jenny Gold, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Noam, first, just to sign up, there's a lot to look at here, but just to sign up, what do we know about where that stands, what the numbers look like a week out from the big deadline?
Well, we know that the administration has got about 5 million signed up so far, probably more than that. Based on the last report we had last week, we think that they may get close to 6 million nationally by the time the sign-up period is over. That's shy of the 7 million goal that had been set ahead of time, but still probably somewhat surprising given how horrific the kickoff of the sign-off period was in October.
Jenny Gold, let's say it's 6 million a week from today or something very close to that. Of course, insurance programs need big participation to work. Is 6 million enough to make this pump run?
So I think the 6 million figure is sort of more of a political number than anything else. I mean, at this point, we've got a pool that's big enough to have a mix of risk, which is what you really want. You want enough young people who are healthy to balance out the older, sicker people. And that's something we don't know a lot about yet. We know that there's about 25% in the younger category, under 35, that are in the pool right now. That's shy of the 38% that the Obama administration set as a target. And we also don't know anything about the health status of those young people. Is it all sort of sicker young people who signed up? If it is, it doesn't much matter that they're young. An insurer would rather have, for example, a healthy 60-year-old than a sick 20-year-old. So we just don't really know that information yet.
Jenny, you said 6 million is enough, but then you said we don't know if it's enough. So which is it?
We know the pool, that's pool size is large enough to have a healthy mix, but we don't know yet whether there actually is a healthy mix in that 6 million.
Noam, what more might we know about, you know, what's under the covers here? Who's signed up, who's been pulled in, what the profile looks like? Jenny says maybe 25% under 35 versus the 38% under 35 they were hoping for. What else do we know?
Well, we know that enrollment is stronger in some places than it is in other places, which is a good sign. The
like
important
what?
Thing to remember. I'm sorry.
Like stronger some places than others. What do you mean by that, and why is that
well,
good?
For, Well, for example, California, which has more than a million people signed up on its health insurance marketplace, is doing quite well, we think, in terms of its enrollment work. There are some states where there are 20, 30,000 people signed up. So the important thing to remember about the Affordable Care Act is that each state has its own marketplace. And so within each state is a different market. And that risk mix that Jenny was talking about before is important in each one of these markets. So when will we know if things are okay in Mississippi or Iowa or California or New York or Boston or Massachusetts? We'll probably know that for sure later this spring when we see what insurance companies want to charge for the second year of this exercise. If a lot of insurance companies look at who they have got in their risk pool and they say, oh my goodness, we have a lot of really sick people. The only way we can stay in business is if we hike up our premiums by 20 or 30 or 40%. We'll know things didn't look so well. If those premiums come back in a range that seems relatively realistic, that's in line with sort of what premiums have been doing the past few years, then we'll have a better sense probably that things may be stable. And it may, as I said, look very different in one part of the country compared to another.
Jenny, that's 50 different arenas for making this risk mix work. Is it possible that we'll have some states with a big sign-up and a good mix, i.e. plenty of young and healthy people in addition to those who need care, and they'll have pretty reasonable cost, price to consumers for this? And a year from now, you may have other states where there's a bad mix and it becomes unaffordable.
That's absolutely right. And you might be surprised about which states end up with a healthy mix and which states don't, because some of the states that were way out in front, that were Democratic strongholds, that ran their own exchanges, actually have had really low signups. Places like Maryland and Massachusetts. And that's largely because their exchanges didn't work. The websites didn't work and people couldn't sign up. You have other states where there was a lot of pushback against the law. States like Florida, where you've actually had a pretty good turnout for signups. And you know, there's lots of different reasons for that. In Florida, for example, that may be because the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan in Florida Blues, they actually brought their A game. They came out and they made a huge play for the exchange market and did a lot of advertising, and people responded.
So I'm trying to get a fix on this, Noam. Does it mean that this is going to work, or could we a year from now have some states where it's working fine and other states where the premiums are so high you actually get numbers dropping and it just falls apart? Or does the whole thing have to work nationally for the Affordable Care Act to work?
Well, I don't mean to dodge the question, Tom, but it's difficult to say at this point. I think the most realistic assessment of what the Affordable Care Act is doing now and what it may do in the future is that we need a couple years to see whether or not this is going to work. That's not going to be satisfying to a lot of the political partisans out there, I know, who want to make a judgment about its success or failure right now. But the fact of the matter is that changing something as complicated as the insurance marketplace for health coverage in this country is very, very complicated. It's time-consuming. It's probably going to take a few years. And if it works well enough, probably in a few places in this country, that's probably enough to keep it going. But you know, the Obama administration and others who support this law are scared to death that there are going to be places in this country where it's not working very well and there are double-digit premium increases. And if it starts failing in various states, that obviously undermines the law pretty dramatically.
Jenny? And I would just add that 2015 is a little confusing. So that's the year we're looking at for what the premium increase is going to be. And probably that's what the political blowback is going to be on the administration and on Democrats, is what the rates are in 2015.
Yep.
But the problem is insurers actually have to set those rates pretty early. They're not going to have very, very many months of claims data to look at. So they're not going to really – the insurance companies aren't going to even have such a good sense of what their health risk mix is, because it's only a few months that they know about.
Jenny, under the law, can the federal government buffer those premium increases if that's what it looks like? Can they subsidize it even more than they're subsidizing it now?
So there are a few built-in mechanisms into the law that would allow them to buffer that a little bit, absolutely.
A little bit, but I'm hearing there that they won't be able to keep people from feeling the hurt if they go way up.
I mean, insurance companies, for example, today there are some articles that came out. They're already saying premiums are going to increase significantly. Now, whether that's based on something they know that we don't know, that's possible. It may also just be based on fear. Since they don't know much, they may be trying to build in some padding of their own.
Wow. I didn't expect to. I mean, okay, it's rolling. They got millions, but we could have a patchy map. And as you say, that would scare the White House to death. That's not what they want to see. Ultimately, Noam, do they feel confident they can get around that? They can beat the drum, you know, this next week and again early next year and get in the millions to make this thing work right?
Well, there's a lot of anxiety, a lot of anxiety at the White House. And I will tell you that my conversations with folks in the insurance industry and others suggest that this critical 2015 period that we're talking about, even though it's only a few months away in the sense that, as Jenny noted, insurers and others have to start looking towards 2015 in a matter of a few months when they start developing their plans. It's still frightening. They're still so focused on right now, they don't know what's going to happen yet in 2015.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Obamacare and how it is unfolding 1 week before the sign-up deadline for the next year, May 31st, a week from today. You're in or you're out till 2015. The president and others pushing hard to get as many in as possible before the deadline a week from today. Here he is on the Ellen DeGeneres show last week, making a pitch to moms with kids in their 20s. President Obama.
If you don't have health insurance right now, you should go on healthcare.gov. And especially all the moms out there who may have young people, 26, 27, don't have health insurance, but they think they're invincible and nothing's ever going to happen to them. You know, what we've said is you never know what life is going to throw at you.
Banging that drum all over the place, the president there with Ellen last week. Of course, there's the counter push. Conservatives, Republicans who do not want acceptance of this. One big group there is Americans for Prosperity. Conservative Koch brothers-backed group has been pouring millions into competitive Senate races around the country, running ads that specifically attack Obamacare. Here's one they released last week that goes after Mark Udall, Colorado Democratic senator now facing re-election.
It's not about a website that doesn't work. It's not about poll numbers or approval ratings. It's about people. And millions of people have lost their health insurance. Millions of people can't see their own doctors. And millions are paying more and getting less. Obamacare doesn't work. It just doesn't work.
Tell Senator Udall to stop thinking about politics and start thinking about people.
Koch brothers, American Prosperity there, hiring actors to say it just doesn't work. In the field, in many places, people are saying it is. Democratic Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear spoke with USA Today, Susan Page, talking about the success of his state's health exchange for Obamacare.
In order to really make a change, you had to have some kind of transformational tool, and the Affordable Care Act came along and gave me that tool. So we grabbed it, we ran with it. We've got 640,000 uninsured Kentuckians. We have so far since October 1st signed up over 244,000 people. I think we'll probably hit about 300,000 before March, at March 31.
A big success story there in Kentucky and a governor who's very happy about it. Jenny Gold is with us this hour, healthcare reporter for Kaiser Health News. Noam Levy is here. He's national healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Let's get our listeners' questions in. John in Des Moines, Iowa. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, you're talking about the March 31 deadline for signing up, and we have a daughter who's attending grad school in Tennessee, and my understanding is Tennessee has extended the deadline for actually purchasing an ACA-compliant policy. So we have her insured, but it's just not an ACA-compliant policy. And I just want to confirm my understanding is correct on that, that we don't have to sign up through an exchange for an ACA-compliant policy by this March 31, and, you know, we won't be subject to the penalty.
To avoid the penalty. Hang on, John. Jenny, what are you hearing in that?
You know, I actually am not sure. I haven't heard that. My understanding is that you are subject to the March 31st deadline, I think, is has not been altered, and I believe that would have to be done on a federal level. But Noam, maybe you have some other thought.
Noam?
Well, I'm hesitant to give you advice about your family situation without knowing everything. But I think if I understand what you're saying is your daughter signed up for a different health plan. And as long as she signed up for a health plan this year, she's not subject to the penalty. The March 31st deadline is the deadline by which you have to have some form of health insurance in order to not be subject to the penalty in the law. So if she has a health plan, even if it's not compliant, if it was an old policy that she renewed, she probably would be okay.
John, good luck. Check with the folks in your neighborhood to be sure. But if you're covered, you're covered here. Steve in Iowa City. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Very simple question. Wouldn't this all be avoided if things were funded like Medicare?
Fund it like Medicare instead of like private insurance company funding? Well, I mean, we crossed that bridge a while ago, but Jenny, how about it? You know, Steve looks at this apprehension in the White House. Noam says, you know, they're scared to death about how it's all going to turn out. When did we decide it was going to be funded like this? Is there any option at this point, Jenny?
A single payer was never really legitimately considered in Congress. The country simply isn't, you know, ready to go there in any way like they have in lots of European countries. So, you know, that was sort of thrown out a long time ago. But in the sense, this is interesting to see. Insurers have a big stake in making this work, because if it doesn't work and you head down the line, that sort of single payer conversation may come up again.
So they have a big interest in making it work. Is that evident, Noam? Can you see that insurance companies are throwing their shoulder to the wheel along with the Obama administration to make this work out? How?
I mean, I don't think there's any question that but for the work by the insurance industry, the law might have already collapsed. I mean, the insurance industry has had a very complicated relationship with the Affordable Care Act since it was debated on the Hill in 2009 and 2010. There's a lot of leeriness about all the regulations that are in there. But at the end of the day, I think many of the insurers recognize that what the law effectively does is deliver to them potentially tens of millions of new customers, many of whom will get government subsidies to buy their product. And at the end of the day, most industries would kill for that kind of support from the government.
If this shouldn't work out, Jenny's suggesting that might mean it would move into single payer, but that's clearly not what Republicans want. If Obamacare, you know, doesn't flourish as a national system.
Wait a second, though. I don't know that single payer is going to be what the answer is. What I said was that I think it may come up as a topic of conversation again.
Yeah. I mean, is there a retreat path for this if it just didn't work?
Well, I don't think it's going to collapse overnight. The earliest that we might see a major reset on the Affordable Care Act would be 2017 with a new president. Even if Republicans take the Senate, President Obama isn't going to let the law collapse. So I think in 3 years we'll know more, obviously, about the law. If at that point it appears that there are parts of the law or large parts of the law that are not sustainable and it has to be reworked, my expectation would be, even if there's a Democratic president or a Republican president, that at that point, the way that health insurance is delivered may be revisited, certainly. I think Jenny's right to be skeptical about whether or not single payer is going to be the answer at that point. But I think it's entirely possible that we revisit sort of how these marketplaces are working, and do the subsidies have to be adjusted? Do the requirements need to be changed somewhat? But it'd be hard to see that the whole law would go away.
What do we know at this point about how the administration and more are beating the bushes to get people signed up? I guess this is partly state by state. I mean, we read reports about people out, you know, actively soliciting Americans to get covered here. Where are they looking? Who are they signing up? Where are they getting their numbers?
So there is a quite extensive, what they call a ground game, that's not unlike the political operation that President Obama deployed for his reelection campaign. And that operation is heavily focused on a few areas of the country with large numbers of uninsured people where they believe they can get the most bang for the buck. So there's a lot of work going on in Los Angeles County, for example. There are 10 million people in LA County alone. It has a huge number of uninsured people. Many of them are low income. Many of them are Latinos. There's a lot of work going on in South Florida. There's a lot of work going on in other major metro areas like Chicago's Cook County, in Houston, Texas. So they're focusing heavily on these areas where they think they can get a lot of people and they individual media markets. What that means is that other parts of the country where there still may be more uninsured people, but it's harder to reach them, are not getting as much attention right now. Those are some rural areas, for example, of the South.
Jenny, people are paying attention. People know there's a penalty out there. How does that bite and when? How does it work?
So it's interesting when people talk about what is encouraging them to buy insurance, the penalty certainly seems to be a big factor. And it's not just the $95 as has been reported. It also can be 1% of your income. So that can get pretty high pretty quickly. And if you don't have a plan by April 1, that can start to kick in.
How does it kick in?
I mean, it's a month by month.
Do they send you
penalty.
A bill? Do they just withhold it from your income tax refund? I've heard they can do that.
Yeah, it's basically a tax penalty.
Oh, so it would show up at the end of the tax year? That's when
right, but it accumulates month by month. So if somehow you get a plan a few months down the line, you would only pay the first 3 months.
So in other words, you don't have to sign up for Obamacare, but you'd have to have some kind of coverage to avoid that penalty.
Sure. So if you were uninsured April 1, but in June you got a new job that provided you a new health insurance plan, you would only have to pay 2 months of the penalty.
Susie in Springfield, Illinois, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Susie.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was a huge proponent for the Affordable Care Act. I was so excited when it was coming through. I am 31 years old, and I chose to finish my college education kind of late. So I've been without insurance, and my husband has a steady job where he's provided insurance, but it would be literally another mortgage payment for us if I went through him. And I have had every issue known to man with the website. I started out when the rollout started. I was unable to actually complete a full application until yesterday. I've made dozens of calls. It was ridiculous. And once I was actually able to see what I was eligible for, I was so angry.
Why?
These plans, and I've done insurance billing in the past, so I know what these terms mean. The deductibles are well over $5,000-$6,000 for the things that I were available for. And I would actually be paying pretty close to what it would get for my husband's plan, which is a far superior plan, but we can't afford it is the thing. So now what we're at is we're weighing the tax penalty against me actually having the benefit of health insurance, but also being broke.
So you found it was so daunting that you'd rather potentially pay the penalty than go on and be covered, Susie?
I would rather pay the penalty than have to pay an additional $300 a month for subpar health insurance, which really isn't going to help me.
Jenny, what are you hearing this story out of Illinois?
I'm hearing a lot of stories like this. One of the biggest questions about the Affordable Care Act is it actually affordable? And a lot of people like Susie are saying it's not. If you earn under 2.5 times the federal poverty level, you're in pretty good shape. You're going to get a big subsidy or you're going to qualify for Medicaid. And you even get a cost sharing subsidy. So you don't, even once you pay your premium, you may not end up having to pay that much after that. But if you're earned over that, your subsidy may be pretty small, or you may not get a subsidy at all. And some of these plans, if you look at sort of the cheaper plans, the bronze level plans that maybe Susie's referring to, they do have very high deductibles. So I think this is a legitimate question consumers across the country are asking themselves.
Noam, what are you hearing on this cost front once people get in and, you know, do the work and see what it would be?
Well, I return to a point I was making earlier about the variation around the country. There are some places in this country where health insurance is extremely expensive. It was extremely expensive before the Affordable Care Act passed. It's very expensive now as well. There are other places that, because of the nature of the local healthcare market, the mix of hospitals and insurers and so forth, where things are much more affordable. And unfortunately, for people like Susie, there are a certain number of consumers who are facing pretty high costs, particularly if they don't get that get subsidies. There are other consumers around the country who are able to get plans for, you know, $50 even, or less, certainly less than $100 with fairly robust coverage. There's a lot of variety out there, and clearly one of the challenges for the law, which was billed as the Affordable Care Act, was to make health coverage and health care affordable for all consumers. That promise has not been achieved yet, clearly.
Jenny, that makes it sound like it's going to be hard to assess this overall. So many variables by household, by state.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're asked constantly now to assess whether this is working now, and it's such a complicated question. Like Noam said, there's huge geographic disparities. It depends on if you live, you know, in the Alpine Mountains, maybe your premiums are extremely high. If you live somewhere else, they might be very low. So you have to sort of look at each state, each grouping separately. And again, it's going to take some time to sort of play out and see whether this is working or not, regardless of whether we hit the 6 million figure.
Yeah, next, a week from today. Sharon in Montpelier, Vermont. Sharon, you're on. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I have two questions.
Yeah.
First, on Veterans Administration insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Is that covered under Vermont Health Connect? And if so, can they get a subsidy for that? And then the other one is on Medicaid. Is Medicaid going to transition over more formally to affordable care, or is it still going to be under the umbrella of Medicaid?
Hang on, Sharon. Jenny, let me bring those to you. Veterans medical benefits, how do those interact with the Affordable Care Act and
Medicaid? My understanding
Medicaid?
Is that's separate. If you have VA insurance, you're not going to be shopping on the exchange.
And you're covered and you're not subject to penalty?
I believe that's right.
And what about the Medicaid question?
I didn't quite understand the Medicaid question.
Sharon, can you elaborate?
Is that under the Health Connect? I mean, when it rolled over, did it stay under Affordable Care Act?
Well, you can sign up for – you should be able to sign up for Medicaid if you qualify through the exchange site. They can tell you whether you earn the right amount to qualify for Medicaid, which should be about under 138% of the federal poverty level. You may have to go to a separate Medicaid office in some way to sign up, depending on the state. But, you know, as part of the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid was expanded, but that's separate than what we've been talking about with the exchange plans.
Sharon, thank you for your call. Noam, how much difference has a state, individual state's kind of posture toward the Affordable Care Act made in terms of the success of rollout? Some have been pretty hostile. Texas made it hard for navigators to sign up to help people. Others have been very friendly. How much difference is that making in the outcome?
Well, Jenny alluded to this earlier, that there have been some surprises. Some states that were very supportive of the Affordable Care Act, Maryland, Oregon, Massachusetts, have actually had quite a lot of trouble technically in setting up their marketplaces. They've had sort of technology issues that bedeviled healthcare.gov at the outset. And some states that were very hostile politically to the law, like Florida, have actually seen quite a lot of sign-up. I think at this point, the most consequential impact of a state's posture has been on this Medicaid question. You'll recall that when the Supreme Court made a decision about Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act last year, they allowed each state to decide. So some states have decided to expand Medicaid, some haven't. That makes a big difference for millions of Americans.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Obamacare and how it is unfolding 1 week before the sign-up deadline for the next year. March 31st, a week from today, you're in or you're out until 2015. Noam Levy is with us from the Los Angeles Times, national healthcare reporter there. Jenny Gold is here, healthcare reporter for Kaiser Health News. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Dahlia Lithwick on contraception coverage under the plan. Some resistance to that from a few employers, Hobby Lobby and more. The Supreme Court's going to be hearing about that tomorrow. We'll check it out. Harvey is calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Harvey, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you.
Look, I was just going to share with you my experience, and I was one of those people who got cut in the fall. My insurance premium at the time was $500 a month.
You were cut because your old policy didn't meet the new standards?
Yes, I would assume that. So they don't explain it to you that way in the letter exactly.
Okay.
But yes, I have to assume that.
Okay.
And the new policy was $1,500 a month. And so I got the extension. You know, the president has sort of delayed my mandatory enrollment in this thing. So I have another year at my current policy, at least maybe even another two. But here's my question. And this is we have a healthcare cost problem in this country. And we seem to be bandying about an insurance scheme. And it's still the relationship between how the costs are really being governed and, you know, this policy back and forth. I'm not convinced that we are addressing the reason why we have to have insurance is that our medical costs are ridiculously high.
Harvey, you're wrestling with this and cutting to the quick of it at the same time. Hang on, let me put that first to Jenny. Harvey had a policy that didn't look so great under the new standards, I guess. You know, it went from 500 to 1,500. Now, like a lot of things, that got rolled back. He's allowed to stay with his old, what they're calling, you know, subpar or whatever policy. You hear that? And then you hear his bigger question about, are we addressing the right problem here?
His bigger question is a really good one. One criticism that's been lobbed at the law repeatedly is that it's really insurance reform, and it doesn't do enough to actually bend the cost curve. The cost of healthcare in the U.S. is extremely high. Now, a lot of that has to do with the costs that are charged by doctors and hospitals and medical device manufacturers, and less to do with the premiums that are set by the insurance companies. Now, there are a few programs within the Affordable Care Act that could help lower costs. For example, these accountable care organizations that are supposed to incentivize doctors and hospitals to give better quality care at a lower cost. But, you know, that's not the real thrust of the law, which was insurance reform. Now, in terms of his previous question about his plan going from $500 to $1,500, you hear that a lot. And I would just say make sure you also look once your current plan does expire, look on the exchange and see if there might be something less expensive there.
Noam, that's just one of the elements of the Affordable Care Act that's been pushed out, that's had its implementation delayed. You know, what else has been delayed? What are the big planks that have been delayed and why?
The Obama administration delayed a penalty on employers that don't provide health coverage. That's probably the biggest one that we've seen so far.
Why did they do that? Why?
Well, they had a lot of problems putting in place the reporting requirements. So in order for the so-called employer mandate to work, employers had to report the number of employees they had because the mandate required employers with more than 50 full-time employees. And calculating that, reporting it on a regular basis to the administration proved quite complicated. The administration was behind on a number of regulations because it was frankly overwhelmed with the process of implementing these marketplaces we've been talking about. So that part of the law is going to be transitioned over the next couple of years into place.
But overall, well, overall, it's there's no easy overall here. Frank in Brookline, Massachusetts. Frank, you're on.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yes.
I'll be brief. I have multiple myeloma, which is a blood cancer. When I left work in 2012, I would have been on my own because I would not have been able to get insurance without what was then the Romney plan in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
With the Romney plan, I have a drug. I take a drug that costs $12,000 a month. With the Romney plan, which is now Obamacare, it costs me $50 a month.
Wow.
I had a stem cell transplant a year and a half ago, which I would not obviously have been able to afford had I not had the Romneycare or Obamacare. I just think that it's a tremendous thing. I mean, Massachusetts, which one of your reporters there said is one of the states that's having difficulty with it. Yeah, it's difficult. Like sometimes you have difficulty with Netflix or when the stock exchange computers collapsed. But overall, this is a great thing for another 40 million American people and for those of us who would not have been able to get health insurance.
Frank, I really appreciate your call. Thank you so much. I mean, there is both the saving grace of this and one tiny piece, bless you, Frank, of the fiscal challenge at the same time, Noam.
It is. And you know, we've talked over this hour, Tom, about the challenges with implementing this law, the technical challenges, the fact that some people are seem to be paying more right now. And I do think it's important to step back and take a look at what the law aims to do. And clearly, for people like Frank who were sick and who could not get access to medical care that they could afford, who faced the prospect of bankruptcy if they got sick, this law delivers something very, very important for those people. And there's an immense amount of evidence that shows that places where people have more health insurance coverage are healthier. And one of the major promises of the law is that as coverage is expanded, as people get more access to the protections from health coverage and access to regular medical care, that their health will increase. And if that happens at the same time that these problems with the implementation of the law happens, that ultimately, I think, may be the ultimate judgment on whether or not the Affordable Care Act works.
1 week for that sign up. Jenny, nobody knows what's going to happen in the elections this fall, but it is possible that we would see a Republican majority in both houses of Congress. If that happens, what do you expect in terms of how they might turn to act on Obamacare?
I'm going to pass that to Noam.
Noam, time is short. A minute here.
Even if the Senate passes to Republican hands, there's almost no chance that the Affordable Care Act could be derailed. There won't be a veto-proof majority. Republicans shut down the government recently over Obamacare and got killed for it. And there's not a lot of appetite among the Republican leadership to do that again. So as long as Obama is in the White House, I think Obamacare is safe. And as I mentioned earlier, I think even with a new president, 3 years down the road, if there are more people like Frank who are getting health coverage and protections, it's going to be pretty hard for even the most ardent Obamacare opponents to take that away.
Jenny, is this like Social Security or Medicare, you know, trouble clicking in, but decades down the road, it'll just be the law of the land, or you don't know yet?
We don't know yet, but I think that's likely. Most programs like this have really struggled in the very beginning. I mean, you can look at the Children's Health Insurance Program. You can look at Medicare Part D. All of them sort of stumbled at first. It's very hard to get a new program rolling. But in the longer term, once this becomes law and people want to hang on to it, or excuse me, once this comes into effect and people want to hang on to it, I think it might be harder to take it away. And I think it might might really become part of the landscape.
Well, you've given us a good sense of that landscape as we head toward that deadline 1 week from today, March 31st. Jenny Gold at Kaiser Health News. Jenny, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Noam Levy at the Los Angeles Times. It's always great to have you. Thank you very much, Noam, for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
In a moment, the Supreme Court is about to hear arguments on the Affordable Care Act and employer coverage of contraception, the Hobby Lobby case, and more. This is On Point. Arguments tomorrow at the Supreme Court over two cases that deal with the requirement under the Affordable Care Act for employers to cover contraception for their employees. Owners of the Hobby Lobby chain of arts and craft shops and Conestoga Wood Specialties, a Pennsylvania maker of wood doors and cabinets, don't want to cover emergency contraceptives, citing religious freedom. At the court tomorrow, we may begin to see which way justices are leaning. With us now from Charlottesville, Virginia, is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate, where she covers courts and the law. Dahlia Lithwick, welcome back to On Point. Thanks a lot for being here.
Good to be here, Tom.
What's at stake in the debate, the arguments tomorrow?
Well, it is exactly what you said. In effect, can for-profit corporations, so these are not religious corporations per se, they're for-profit corporations, can they get themselves exempted from what we would think of as neutral, generally applicable laws based on an argument that their religious freedoms are violated by those laws? So the consequences could be massive if the court says, yes, employers can, for religious purposes, be people the same way they could be people after Citizens United. If they're allowed to be people for religious purposes, then that really calls into question other generally applicable laws.
Now, religious organizations have already been exempted from some of this, right?
That's right. Churches, Catholic schools, hospitals have already been exempted, and other exemptions were granted. So along the way, the Obama administration has tried to grant exemption after exemption to accommodate religious institutions. Here, though, the feeling was, look, this is not a religious institution. Hobby Lobby is a huge chain of stores. There's 500 stores, 13,000 employees. The Green family, who owns Hobby Lobby, says, yes, even though we're a for-profit corporation, we're still religious. We're closed on Sunday. We play Christian music in the stores. And so they're arguing that even though we're a for-profit corporation, we're still a religious entity, and that's really the question.
Now, I guess this isn't the question, but if it were just the Green family, a privately owned company, would it be different?
Absolutely. And one way the court can get out of this is to say, well, even though they're a for-profit corporation, it's closely held, it's a family company, and therefore we're going to say the religious rights at issue attach to the Green family itself, or in the Conestoga case, to the family itself. And that certainly is one way for the court to get out of the larger problem by saying in these cases, we're talking, even though they're for-profit corporations, we're talking about what is fundamental. A family corporation.
But then you could have any lawn mowing company or lemonade stand say, we don't want to do this. It doesn't match our religious beliefs and dictates.
Well, that's exactly right. And no less a person than Justice Antonin Scalia wrote that in a big 1990 religious case called Employment Division versus Smith. And it was Scalia who said in that instance, the First Amendment just cannot afford religious exemptions from generally applicable laws to every single religious objector. So after that case in 1990, Congress went ahead in 1993 and passed RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and that was intended to sort of bolster the religious protections for religious people who felt that their rights were being trampled. And it's important to note that the cases tomorrow are going to come up both under the First Amendment religious freedom clauses and also under RFRA.
What contraceptives are they objecting to?
Well, part of the problem here is that different employers object to different things depending on their own religious faith. So some of them, in this case, object to just the IUD. Some of them object to Plan B and Ella. Some object to different configurations. So it's not just a question of, law here. There's a question of different faiths are going to draw the line at different places depending on what they see as abortive fashions, and different religions are going to find those places different. So,
abortive fashions meaning that it would let that very recently impregnated embryo go, the Plan B morning after pill idea.
Exactly. I mean, I think the scientific community generally feels that none of these contraceptions cause abortions per se, but different faiths draw that line at different places. And so if you draw it at implantation versus fertilization, there's a whole range of questions. And so different faiths have simply said Ella is okay, IUDs are not okay. Part of the complexity of this case is how you test for those things, if you're going to test for those things, given that science says no abortion-producing drug can be covered. None of these cause abortions.
Boy, you could have lines running all over the place here. Hobby Lobby has about 13,000 full-time employees, lots of outlets. Conestoga Wood, this is a Mennonite family that owns it in Pennsylvania, Conestoga Wood Specialties. It's owned by the married couple and their three sons. Does the size of these suggest that the court might lean toward, well, these are really just personally owned companies, or Hobby Lobby's pretty big?
Hobby Lobby's pretty big. I mean, Conestoga employs 950 workers. Hobby Lobby, as you said, employs 13,000 workers. It's important to note those workers don't necessarily share the faith of the employers. So another set of rights that gets a little bit elided in this conversation, Tom, is the rights of the employees, not just their religious rights. In other words, why does their employer's religion trump theirs? But also their right to contraception, to what is seen as just basic preventive care. And so it is very, very complicated. But as to your threshold question, the court can certainly say, look, the Green family is just different. and that in this case it looks a lot more like a closely held family corporation than Google does. But I think it's a tricky line to draw because it is a nonprofit corporation and it is a corporation.
It's a for-profit corporation.
I'm sorry, you're exactly right. It's a for-profit corporation and it's a corporation that quite explicitly doesn't act in religious ways. It sells craft products. And so that's a tough line for the court, but they can use it if they want to find a middle way.
If corporate personhood is extended in this way, does it have ramifications beyond healthcare?
Well, I mean, I think it's certainly the case that once you start to argue that corporations, in addition to having free speech rights, have faith rights and religious freedom rights, it does throw open the door to all sorts of objections and exemptions that corporations can get. And you see that slippery slope not just as applied to healthcare, but in dissents and opinions in the appeals courts where judges say, can you imagine if you object to basic civil rights law, if you say women should be subordinate to their husbands, does that mean that you can treat your women employee differently? So the court has looked at this in a case, you know, the court has looked at this issue of whether employees can simply be trammeled in terms of employer rights in a 1982 case, United States v. Lee. This was an Amish farmer who objected to paying Social Security taxes for religious reasons. And the court said, absolutely not. So the precedent does not heavily favor Hobby Lobby or Conestoga in these cases, Tom, but it is a dramatic and radical new argument, and we're in an era where faith really matters to this Supreme Court.
The Hobby Lobby case and more to be argued tomorrow before the U.S. Supreme Court. Dahlia Lithwick with Slate. It's always great to have you. Thank you so much for your insight, Dahlia.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, thanks for joining us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.